Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. I've got the show today actually split into two parts, but the first half, we're going to be talking with some folks from the world of theater, and they're involved with a production that's coming up by John Beguinet, and it's actually part of a trilogy that he put together, and it's called Shotgun, that's going to be taking place here in Lafayette. But my guest today is actor, musician, because people forget that sometimes, don't they?
I do, too.
Yes. Let's remember that. Musician, heck of a guitar player, and probably one of the best set designers in this area, Duncan Thistlewaite.
Hi, Cheryl.
It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
It's good to see you. We should have had you brought your guitar. We should have had
you.
Oh,
my God.
Yeah.
You'd be turning off the radios all over KDM.
I don't think so, Duncan. And also Walter Brown, who is the director of this production, but also has been involved in acting and set design and has done a lot of producing, and somebody who's, you know, we're glad he's back in town because he did live away for a period of time, but has done a lot in the area for getting people involved in theater. And I think one thing, Walter, that I always think with you is the teaching that you have brought to this area for theater. You know, there, and especially for adults, which I always think it's tough when you get to the adult age and you take your first stab at something like acting, because you have so many more thoughts that are in your head that aren't necessarily there when you're nine.
That's for sure.
You know, and I think that's a gift that you have in terms of walking people through that process. So, Walter Brown, and then Rudy Eisenzoff. Which, Rudy, I don't know as well, so we'll get to know you better today. But Rudy is one of the stars of this production, Shotgun. And like we were talking, I first got to see you in Cooper Helms' Buried Child. And you were fascinating in that production.
That's one way to describe it.
I'm going to start with some of that, but there was real physical acting with that in terms of your body movement, your facial expressions, but just how you carried yourself in that character. When one prepares for a role like that, how do you prepare for that? Is a mirror ever in use?
Or for me, a mirror doesn't help. It's mainly just getting to know that character inside and out. And when you do that, you actually develop a certain walk. You develop certain movements, you know, once you really get into that character. And sometimes even all of that working together, you know, you become one cohesive person.
Like in your head, there's just a sense or like a feel that, okay, I have this down. I know what I'm projecting out to.
Yeah.
You know, not being an actor or anything like that, I always think that some of those things, like I would have to do them in front of the mirror to see.
And sometimes when I'm running lines and I'll just automatically either develop a limp or I'll walk a certain way or I'll move a certain way just because that's the way it felt like that particular scene would call for that, and it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, you were very enjoyable to watch in that production.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was fascinating. Walter, I'm going to start with you on this, but can you give us a little bit of history of, I know that the author of this production that you're involved with, Shotgun, this is part of a trilogy.
That's right.
You did with, go ahead.
Yeah, John Beguinet, he had stayed through the storm, and he was blogging.
And this is
lot.
Hurricane Katrina.
Hurricane Katrina, yeah. And he was chronicling what happened in New Orleans, how the storm was damaging it, how people were coping with it afterwards. He had a lot of stories that he wanted to tell about it. And as he was watching the city try to rebuild, he wanted to tell the story of how people cope with the various elements of some kind of a massive disaster like this, how they relate to each other, how they can help each other, how the environment forces them into being people they wouldn't necessarily be, or situations that cause them to see themselves in a new light. So he picked three really kind of iconic moments for people who were involved in Katrina, or in our area for Rita, because it was a lot of the same thing. The first one, which is Rising Water and premiered at Southern Rep, is the
actual – And
that's
actual, in New Orleans.
That's Southern set Rep. In New Orleans, yeah. It's actually –
No, but I mean Southern Rep's in New
Orleans.
Oh,
yeah, Southern Rep is in New Orleans. And they will be premiering his latest one, Mold.
And that's, so, is that the one at the Swine Palace in Baton Rouge?
Rising right. Water is at the Swine Palace in Baton Rouge.
Oh, okay. Where's Mold?
Mold will be at Southern Rep.
Oh, okay. That's all right.
Mold is at Southern Rep. So his first one, Rising Water, is the frightening situation of being in the attic as the water rises and trying to cut your way out and realizing that you have to save yourself, that there's no one left to turn to. And that involves just two people. It's a really intense two-person show. And then the next problem became, well, what happens after you survive? But there's really nothing to come home to. We still want to be at home. We still have to find some place to land. There was no home for people. They were trying to get money from the government to help pay just for motel rooms, which were ridiculously expensive. Rents had gone up. FEMA trailers were not available for everyone. And people were forced into proximity that they necessarily wanted to be. Families were forced to double up and triple up. Strangers were living with each other. So our second play, Shotgun, is really about what happens when two families from very different backgrounds are forced to live together and try to find common ground. Can they do it? Can the pressures of the situation help them, or are they going to hurt attempting to do this? And how much healing can you do in a relatively short period of time with so mm-hmm. much loss? And then the third one, which is Mold, is about people who are part of the diaspora from this. They're in Houston. One of the people wants to come home. The other one doesn't. Has made a new life. Well, is a new life better in a new place? Does New Orleans call you home? What's the power of home?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you come back when you've been away for so long?
Yeah.
Almost, do you even have a right to come back?
How did you all get involved in this trilogy? You know, Protonon, one of the productions.
It was a stroke of luck. Our artistic director, Marie Diaz, had been looking on the net, and she was contacted by, I think, the people from Southern Rep, who wanted to have sort of a statewide festival to announce the new opening of this last play, Mold, by John Biguenet. And so they were looking for other theaters that would be interested in partnering up with them so that we could present all three plays in a period of about a month, and people mm-hmm. who wanted to could go to see all three of them. Southern Rep was already going to premiere Mold. And so Swine Palace took Rising Water. And we were fortunate. We were the ones who had the winning bid for coming in with Shotgun. So we're in there with the two equity houses in our area.
Fabulous.
Which we're really happy about. But we also picked the play. I mean, it was nice because it involved a bigger project, and it was a way of getting the story of Katrina out to the state again and reminding people. And it tied up nicely with Hurricane Sandy. But it's a play that was worth doing all on its own. These plays are all independent in the characters and the situations. The overarching story is what unites them. This is a play that I think we would have liked to have done regardless.
Sure. Rudy, what attracted you to this production and then to the character that you're playing?
Well, I mean, Marie gave me the script to read, and I read it, and I knew immediately that I wanted to be a part of it, whether it was as an actor or just working behind the stage or anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Everything about Katrina that is in the story is kind of just a backdrop to what really is a couple different love stories within the play. And that's really what the story is. That what makes it so that you could, you know, do it the way we're doing it with the other two theaters, or it could stand out on its own.
Yeah.
You know? But just that the whole character of Bo is...
And that's who you're playing.
That's who I'm playing.
Yeah.
There's so many different levels to him. And really, it was a challenge that I was looking for.
Yeah.
Thankfully, Walter's the one that's directing it, because I don't know if I could get out of this character what I wanted to without him.
And what did he bring to you that allowed you to...
Insight.
Huh.
Yeah, mainly insight to certain aspects of the character that I did not see initially. The fact that he's... Yeah, I mean, on the surface, he's angry because of what happened, but there's sadness in him, and there's compassion in him, and there's love in him, and he's lost.
Yeah, yeah. And some of that, I don't know if it's with that character, but you see it happen so often. Some of that just gets masked and covered up by – usually by the anger. And,
yeah.
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 Yeah. excuse me. And Duncan, how did you get involved in this production?
Well, Marie Delahoussaye Diaz, she
said – get the whole name in there.
It's very important. she said, hey, we're going to do Shotgun. And I knew about the play because I was lucky enough to have seen the production of Shotgun at Southern Rep about three or four years ago, and it just blew me away. It was a beautiful production, beautifully cast and directed. I think their artistic director, Amy Hayes, directed it. And it was really wonderful. It was really moving and touching. And luckily enough, the show I saw afterwards, there was a talk back with John Becknay. The author gave a talk back, so we stayed for that. So I had the full Shotgun experience.
Yeah.
So when Marie Delahoussaye Diaz said, would you like to be on board and design the set for the show? I said, yes. So I jumped on immediately with both feet, and I was in.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you see a production done somewhere else and with their own set and what their ideas were for the set, how does that affect what you do? I mean, you know, I'm good
in
or
this
bad.
Case, it was intimidation because Southern Rep is there. It's an Equity House. It's a regional theater, and their work is superb. But they took a very specific direction with the set. It was very dreamlike and suggested and almost not there. The actors in their costumes and the that was the element of the layer of realism that you saw. Everything else was just a dream, sort of, literally, the way they painted the set, the absence of any sort of verticality. There were no doors or windows or anything. So it was – they took a very specific direction, and I just went the opposite way, and you'll know why. When we did Proof at CTA, I think you were there, weren't you?
When you did Proof, yes, sir.
With the house.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's the direction I took with this show, was to actually put the whole edifice on stage so that, you see the whole house in very realistic detail. There's a house in the theater, which is the opposite of what they did at Southern Rep, which was very suggestive and dreamlike. So I used the Proof approach for Shotgun, and that's where we are.
You know, and for people who have not seen and I know it's not just me, but other people will talk at times that the set many times is another character, you know?
I think that's true.
It is. And your sets really are, you know, another character. They also are places, this also being a house, as you had done a house in Proof. If you haven't seen one of Duncan Thistlewaite's set, go to this production for many reasons, but go to see his sets because you want to live in the house, you know, until you get behind
it. Well, we can charge rent.
No, but I mean, you know, it's and I'm curious where that comes from you, the understanding and the talent to create those architectural structures, because that's not an easy thing to do on a stage.
Well, you know, theater is all about tricks and deceiving the eye, and so in a way it's you don't really have to know a lot about building to build what looks like a house. You just fake it with flats and Walter shaking his head in agreement. It's all an illusion, and so none of the realities of load-bearing walls and windows that would have glass, none of that applies, and so you're sort of set free to work, to play with tricks is really sort of what it is. And,
yeah.
And that's an interesting way to work and be creative.
Can you talk about some of the tricks you did with this one?
But the main trick in theater is that, you know, you go behind the set and there's nothing there. So,
I
mean, we start with that trick. I don't know.
I think, Duncan, what I think about is because, like, Proof, you really did some research on what a house would look like in that area of Chicago.
I did, yes.
And, you know, and there's something about, you know, I think sometimes when people talk about flats, well, you think of just these big pieces of plywood, and now the set that you designed for this production, my guess is you based it on maybe some homes that would have been done in a certain area.
Well, it's all about the shotgun. I mean, the name of the play is
exactly.
Shotgun, which
that's
alludes
right.
to a very specific kind of architectural form that's in New Orleans.
And so how do you turn that flat piece of plywood into something that looks like a shotgun or that home from Chicago?
Well, in New Orleans, and the shotgun houses of New Orleans are very specific and very iconic in that they have certain architectural details that even though they vary from house to house, they're all part of the shotgun vernacular.
Yeah.
And part of that is what they call corbels.
What is that?
And it's the
– Say the word again.
Corbels.
Okay.
C-O-R-B-E-L-S. It's those things that seem to support the porch roofs. They're very ornate in New Orleans frequently, and they're very iconic. And when you see them, you think, oh, well, that's a house in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the focuses of this set was getting those and having that image – you know, that visual image there, you know, for the audience and for the actors to say, this is a house, this is a shotgun house in New Orleans. And I worked a lot on those to get them to look nice.
Yeah. And there's also, I note, different techniques that you do with paint and painting that when you're sitting out in the audience gives it that, I don't know, it's like 3D isn't the term.
Like
but
depth or something.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, you know, this house has siding on it, and you can use paint and different values of paint and what they call washes to make the siding look old
yeah.
and weathered and dusty and dirty and part of what you would see on any street in New Orleans. And so there are those kind of techniques that apply.
Yeah. You. It's nice as a director to – have him.
Oh, yes.
Have him on your, you know, excuse me. But the other thing that I, you know, with this production, I mean, you, let's set the actors aside for a minute, but you also have, you have Brady McKellar and you have Travis Johnston.
Yes. We have a couple of the professors from UL who are coming in and they're, Travis Johnston's doing our lights for us. Brady McKellar's doing our costumes for us. It's a nice chance for us to have a closer relationship with the university, a nice chance for them to show the community some of what they do in a community setting mm-hmm. rather than just at work.
Yeah. You've got, as a director, there has to be some comfort with who you have in the background helping you out with these
things. Oh, yeah.
Things.
Yes, it's very nice to have a technical team that you can rely on and feel comfortable with.
That's right. The other folks that you have in the cast, you have Cody Dunstan, Andrew Hunter, who I absolutely love Andrew Hunter, Angela Thomas, Daniel Wiltz round out the cast along with Rudy. Rudy, with what Duncan was talking about with the set, how do you as an actor – what do you have to pay attention to, or what do you pay attention to in a production when working with a set?
That the stoop is about a foot high.
Yeah.
I mean, for the first part of rehearsal, we rehearse on a floor. So the first time you go in there to use the set, you got to remember there's a stoop there, or it will hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. The best thing about the set.
I mean, you have to change a whole. I mean, there's quite a few things you have to change once the set is there.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, and this particularly goes to Duncan's skill. The first night we were there with the set, we felt like we were home. You know, and it made it easier.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that the doors do open and close and you don't have to worry about working, making sure they close all the way. They actually do close all the way, you know, making sure, you know, that you lean up against something, it's not going to fall over.
Yeah.
You know, that's important because when you're up there in the plane, you're doing something and you feel like your character's going to lean back against the wall. You want to make sure that the wall is going to be there.
That's right.
When you lean back.
Yeah.
And the other great thing, as far as I can see from the audience standpoint, they are going to feel like they are sitting in the street in front of this house watching mm-hmm. these people interact. And that really, I mean, just the way the set is, they are going to be so totally immersed in the play themselves.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic.
How did theater come into your life? When did you get started in theater?
Well, I mean, high school.
Oh, okay.
And then I did some theater in college in Maryland where I grew up. And then when
you're from the state of Maryland?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then I went to did some theater when I was in the service. And then I did some theater when I went back to school in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Went to North Carolina State University.
What branch of the service were you in?
The Air Force.
And so was theater a part of Air Force theater?
It was just like community theater on the base.
Oh, wonderful.
That's all it was.
Yeah.
Really, you know. But then I took a break for about 15 years.
And what brought you back?
The Roadkill Diner.
Which was Dennis Ward's piece. That's right. You were in the Roadkill Diner.
Yep.
That's where I first saw you. Okay.
Yeah.
That was quite a show.
You know, I was sitting home one day and I saw, I think it was on Facebook or something, a call for an audition for this. And I said, it's time.
Yeah.
It's time. It's something it's hard to explain to people that haven't acted, not that I'm being condescending, but when you're an actor, you just feel like it's something you have to do.
Yeah.
And I just feel like I have to do it. I'm so comfortable doing it. You know, I love the rehearsal process. I love, you know, I always said, you know, people come to a play for a few minutes of escape from their lives. But what they don't understand is they are giving me the exact same thing. They are giving me the opportunity to escape for an hour or two every night. And I so appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good place to be when you're able to find that in your life.
Yeah.
You know, Duncan, I'm curious because, you know, I brought up music. And, I mean, music played quite a role in your life. I mean, when you were younger.
Yeah.
A lot.
I played in bands for 30 years.
Exactly. So I'm curious. I mean, and you're not playing music as much anymore, except maybe if you're at home.
I jump ship.
Know. Yeah. So how did that come about to switch like an art form like that?
It was sort of natural and it was a progression. I was playing in a band that had been, I think when I quit, I had played in the same band for 27 years. It was the Hubcats, and then it turned into the Robbie Bush Band, and it was, you know, that thing. And then I auditioned for 12th, this was in 2001, auditioned for 12th Night at Abbey Players. Cody Daigle was directing.
Wait, had you acted before?
No. But teaching, I was an English teacher, you know, in the daytime, and at night we played me. Teaching Shakespeare to kids really opened that up for me, and I thought I would really like to stand up and say some of this, you know, because Shakespeare is just, she's Shakespeare, you know.
Yeah.
So I went down, auditioned, and got the role of Orsino in 12th Night, and I was completely gone after that. And I kept playing music, but then I started getting more roles, and these are both nighttime activities, and there was a point at which I had to choose whether I was going to go to band rehearsal or take a role and rehearse. And I just said, well, there was no question. I was out of there. I've hung the guitar up and I have played very little since, actually.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, having taught Shakespeare for that long and then being a part of a production, did you think back to how you taught Shakespeare? Did it change your idea of Shakespeare or how you taught that process of Shakespeare?
Well, it deepened it for me, because then you were inside the play speaking out instead of outside the play speaking in about it.
Okay.
And that was a revelation to do that. I knew a lot about how Shakespeare is read and the form that he wrote in and stuff. So I could bring those things to my acting about it. But it didn't really affect the acting. It just gave me more background about what I was doing.
Yeah.
So it did help. Yeah, it did help teaching it all those years immensely, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Walter, with this production, Shotgun, what do you hope the audience takes when they leave the theater at the end?
I'd like them to get a sense of the resiliency of people, that even in the worst of circumstances, even when we're not always at our best, there's a good core in there that can build. It's we were thinking partly about the image of the flower that grows up to the crack in the sidewalk. When something floods, when a big forest fire comes in, plants recede almost immediately. The kind of coming back to life, the image we were thinking of in this play is that everybody has a house, everybody wants a home. And that's what they're all looking for in this play, which is one reason that we wanted the house, the iconic house on the stage, because everybody confuses house with home in this play.
Hmm.
And they have to realize that home and house are not the same thing. They have to accept that before they can move on.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about John Biguenet's production of Shotgun that actually is being presented by Acting Unlimited. And it's going to be opening March 9th. And it's going to be at Theater 810 here in downtown Lafayette, which is a wonderful space. It's a great space in there. And we'll play March 14th through the 16th at 7:30 and March 10th and the 17th at 3 p.m. If you're interested in tickets, one of the best things you can do is go to the Acting Unlimited website, which is actingunlimited.org. You can also find them on Facebook. Music, because we're going to go out. I'm so glad you guys were able to come on today, but we're going to go out with some music that you're using. Is that music actually being used in the production? Does music come in, or is it
pre-show?
Pre-show.
During
okay.
the show itself, all the music is dead.
Yeah.
The only music that we play, but it is important in the show, is actually played by Bo.
Wait, say that again?
The character of Bo plays
the only – Rudy is playing.
Mm-hmm. Rudy plays the only music you hear during the production.
Oh, very nice.
And then Daniel Wiltz right at the end, Dr. Daniel Wiltz.
We're going to use all that loosely. thanks to Duncan, I'm able to play the guitar.
Yeah. You know. See, well, look that's great how that came in.
My musical training came in.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, it's two songs primarily. One is a song that the character of Bo's father taught him when he was a boy, and it's the one he sings. It's called My Home's Across the Smoky Mountains.
And are you singing in the production? And
yes.
Do you sing?
He does now.
I do now. I sing. It doesn't – in the play, the character of Bo, he sings, but it's like, you know, any father singing in the kitchen. I mean, it's not going to be perfect.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then the other song is Goodnight Irene, which is actually sung by me and Dex, which is Dr. Wiltz.
Oh, Dr. Wiltz plays. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we look forward to that. And again, that's opening March 9th at Theater 810 here in downtown Lafayette. And that's Shotgun, which is part of a trilogy. And there's on the Acting Unlimited website, too, if people want to find out about the other productions in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, that's also on there.
Yes, we have links for them. We have all the dates where they can get the contact information, a little bit about each play. Yeah, we're doing our best to try to encourage people to see all three of them.
Wonderful. Well, Duncan Thistlewaite, Walter Brown, and Rudy Eisenzoff, appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we look forward to the production. We're going to go out listening to a piece called it's going to be track one, Cecil, When the Levee Broke by Monica Dillon. And then when we come back, we're going to visit with some folks with the Acadiana Food Circle.
Wasn't right, my heart was so heavy. when the levee broke. On their feet, and the only thing that they could say was a baby picture of me. When the levee broke, my kinfolk lost everything they had, except the love for each other, the father, my mother.
Welcome back, and I want to thank everybody coming on from the production of Shotgun for the first part of the show, and we're now going to switch from theater to food, which is, I think, a good thing. It's a good segue, but my guests I have for the second half here are all involved with local food, whether that's in promoting or growing, preparing, any of that. We have two local food producers. We have Jeannie Plaisance and Brian Gautreaux. And then Tyler Thigpen, who I think kind of ties everything together and is really helping get the word out.
I try.
To the community. Yeah. And all a part, too, of Acadiana Food Circle.
Yes.
So welcome.
Thank
it's great
you,
to have
Carol.
You
Thanks
on
for
here
me.
Today.
To be here.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing we had talked a little bit about this, but what I'd like to talk about first is, I think, is let people know a little bit about Acadiana Food Circle and what that's all about.
Okay.
You want to talk about that, Tyler?
Yeah. Our mission is connecting local consumers to local producers like Brian and Jeannie, and to educate the public on local healthy food sources. And the way we do that is we have a website, www.acadianafoodcircle.org, and it has a comprehensive local foods directory.
Can I say people need to click on that directory?
Yeah, it's big, and it's only growing. We're revising it right now, so we're going to have a new one up soon.
Yeah, go to the website because it lists all the different farmers markets, mm-hmm. the farm stands, the grocers, community supported agriculture, a lot of the different local artisans, mm-hmm. Gardening resources, eateries. I loved the whole thing about when you should grow what when. When you
yeah.
should plant.
Oh gosh, and our harvest calendar has
it
even
is.
Gotten better. We have the new directory, and that's coming out
that's
in April.
I haven't seen.
Yeah, it's not on the website yet, but it's funded by the Healthy Living Club, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Healthy Initiatives Grant.
Okay.
And so we're going to have that up soon and in print by April.
Okay. So the whole importance of eating local mm-hmm. and eating fresh, I want to talk about some terms that you see a lot when you're reading about some of that. And you see it on your website, and that's mm-hmm. the slow foods movement. Mm-hmm. And if you're not involved in going to farmers markets or involved with people that are involved with that movement, it's hard to understand what is that.
It's true. It's a little intimidating at first.
Yeah.
When I got into it, I didn't know that local foods and slow foods were synonymous. Slow foods is kind of a play on fast food. You know, it's not,
so that's where that term came
yeah,
in. You know what? I always thought I was thinking because of the growing, you know, how things when they're naturally grown.
Yeah,
that it's a might be a slower process.
Well, it is. Yeah, it is because it's more. And Brian will tell you about this, but it's more nutrient dense. That's a phrase that the Gauchos use a lot. And there's a lot more that goes into local foods and growing locally. It's not mass produced, and it takes longer to do it in the more, you know, conventional way of growing it on like we used to.
Exactly. That's an important thing you said, like people used to.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right, and that's part of the name Acadiana Food Circle. It's all about kind of getting back to your roots. It's a circle, you know. That's where that comes from.
And Brian, your whole family is involved.
Yes, we are.
You know, you have kids,
right?
But I'm curious, did you grow up farming?
I grew up in a rural community where there were a lot of farmers. I did work for some rice farmers and soybean farmers. Always had a backyard garden. Even as a child, I would beg my mom and dad to let me get some chickens, let me plant a garden, and the whole family would reap from it, of course. But I've always loved doing that.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up between Hathaway and Jennings.
Between Hathaway and Jennings. Okay.
Yes.
All right. And then as you got older, how did it become where – I mean, it plays a major role in your life.
Yes, it does. You know – I got married to my wife Dawn shortly right out of high school and went in the service, and because there was really no jobs to be found around there.
Sure.
So when I got back from the service, opened my own business, an auto repair business, and found a need for clean food. You know, just a personal family need for, you know, wanting foods that weren't so toxic for us.
Yeah.
So we started growing it and just found that the community, you know, there was a need beyond my family for it. And we just started expanding little at a time to where we are now. And
Yeah, because you do a lot of really fascinating things. I mean, really, you know, for people that, I mean, even different from just somebody who has, you know, a small kind of backyard garden. I think some of the things that you do with some of the fish, are you still
yes,
raising fish?
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. You know, every facet of our farm, we look at our farm as a miniature micro ecosystem.
Yeah.
Our little 22-acre ecosystem. Where we want we bring in as little as we possible, as we can possibly in the matter of inputs, but we are able to rotate our crops with our animals and our fishes and bring the whole, you know, in nature, birds follow omnivores, and you know, there's fishes in the water, and then the water from the fish can benefit the plants, and it brings a full circle.
So yeah, I mean that's a process you have all set up.
Yes.
See, that's okay.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's my observing continually of how would these things grow if I weren't here, if you know, if we as humans weren't on the planet, how would they grow?
Yeah.
And so we, you know, my job is to assist everything in growing and orchestrating everything, but we like to see things grown the way they would naturally grow.
And I'm curious because there's a lot of books out there written on the subject now. I mean, there's a lot more than there ever was, or articles. Do you ever learn from reading what other people are putting out there, or is it simply from observation?
In the beginning, I did. You know, my mind was triggered by writings of other farmers. You know, there's the famous farmers that were on some of the documentaries recently that I contacted directly and asked them questions. And it was, I guess, it set off ideas, you know, because the way their growing processes don't work in the deep coastal south where we're at.
Sure.
You know, we were failing on a lot of those things trying to mimic what they were doing.
Yeah.
But it also, it gave me the ideas that, you know, how would things grow down here, coastal southern Louisiana?
You know, it's interesting because I started gardening, I guess I was in my 20s. I mean, we had gardens when I was a kid, but really paying attention. But this was up in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in that area. Uh-huh. And when I moved here, I became very frustrated with gardening because there were some things that I had to deal with. And I'm thinking it's because of not having the severe freezes
that's got
during
a lot
the winter.
To do with it. Sure,
you know, in
sure.
terms of some
pest problems,
exactly, and just I don't know, fungus stuff and
right?
all that.
Absolutely.
That I quit for a while because I was like, oh, because it was, I have to say, it was very easy where I mean, it was pretty easy where I grew up, you know. But that, you know, so when you talk about down in this coastal area, it's, I don't know. It's a different.
It's a challenge.
It is.
We were told it couldn't be done.
And you're doing it.
We're doing our best.
That's right. Jeannie, how did you get involved in growing?
Well, I grew up with a dad who was a gardener, and he had a green arm, as we say. We had lots of citrus trees, and he had all kind of different
fig
trees.
And you grew up down here?
I grew up in New Iberia, mainly. And he always had a really big garden. And I'd share that with us, you know, go pick the eggplant, go pick the peas, you
That's
know,
right.
sort of thing. And he would take us out into nature, too, and we'd go blackberry picking and fishing and that sort of thing. And I always loved that.
Yeah.
And I loved it so much that I ended up getting a degree in horticulture from here at USL back in the 70s. And been growing a garden since I was about 19 years old.
Yeah. Do you do it as a business also?
I do.
Oh, you do?
The last couple of years, I have been.
And do you go to local farmers markets?
Yeah, I sell at the Freetown Farmers Market.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Every Wednesday.
And is there something or products that you specialize in?
Well, I do a lot of specialty vegetables, unusual vegetables I like to grow.
What? Tell me
like
about
purple carrots and Romanesco cauliflower, the unusual cauliflowers, things that you don't see every day or that you can't see in any supermarket that you'd go in.
Yeah.
That really, you want to try something different.
Yeah.
I guess being a gardener for so long, I want to try something different.
Sure.
So.
I have to say, Jeannie does microgreens really well.
Yes, I do.
Now, can you explain what microgreens are?
Oh, she's the expert.
Yeah. Somebody explain what microgreens are.
I'm not really the expert, but I recently, at the request of a restaurateur here, started dabbling with it. And it's really just a small plant that you cut before it grows out. You know, it's like a sprout without the tail, without the root. And it's just a very delicate green used in garnishes, used in salads. And you can use different kinds of seeds to get different kind of flavors and colors. And they're very tasty. A lot of people like them. And nutritious.
And really healthy, yeah, very healthy.
And are they, so I'm trying to get a picture of this. So microgreens, I mean, they're
you grow them in a tray.
Yeah.
In a greenhouse, you have to have a covered area to really protect them from the elements. And, you know, they germinate, they grow, and before they really put out true leaves, you have the seed leaves. And
yeah.
first couple of true leaves come out and you cut them, and that's the end of that plant.
And is there some kind of nutritional reason that you keep them
No, it's really, I think, more for attractiveness and that sort of thing. There have been some studies done about the nutritional value. It's not as off the charts as some people think it is, but the seed has put forth all its energy and life energy into that little bit of sprout
right there.
So you're getting pretty good vitamins and minerals there.
Yeah. And you got involved how, Tyler?
Well, there are several reasons why I love the local foods movement. I lived in some places that didn't have local foods. I lived in the desert. I lived in Antarctica where we couldn't get anything fresh.
Okay, let's back up a second. So what took you to Antarctica?
I was doing phytoplankton research for Scripps in La Jolla, California.
Huh. So,
I was down there for a few months.
Yeah.
The austral summer of 06 and 07, and we had nothing fresh. If a cruise ship came down, they'd give us some fruits and vegetables, and that's it. So everything was frozen. And that'll really make you appreciate something fresh.
My guess is you really noticed some things with your body at that time in terms of cravings.
Oh, my
gosh.
I mean, the experience was amazing, but my body changed so much. I became so unhealthy, and I gained a lot of weight.
Yeah.
All those processed foods, it was hard to recover from that. For sure. But when I got back, or any time a cruise ship came down, we were pretty excited to see fresh foods. And then I did a master's on the effects of herbicides on DNA fragmentation, liver cell metabolic activity, and endocrine disruption here at UL.
Yeah.
And so I spent all my time, 80 hours a week, doing that, and I got done, and I didn't know what to do. So then that's when we kind of got together and started AF's Acadiana Food Circle. And, I had a greater appreciation for the local foods versus what's being mass produced all over the world.
Yeah. Do you grow at all?
I don't. I leave it to the experts.
You
because,
do. Yeah.
You know, I get to taste
you
their
consume.
Amazing. I consume. I'm a consumer. I tried, but I could never replicate it. And it's just not as good when I do it.
That's right, isn't it?
I can grow some passion vines and stuff that's not necessarily edible to humans.
Yeah.
Flowers are good.
Yeah. Flowers are good, aren't they?
Yeah.
With Acadiana Food Circle, like I said, the great thing about it that – and really, again, on your website, you've done such a good job at that whole bit that you talk about with connecting people to places that they can go. To get you know, if they themselves don't want to grow. But also I love the part where you added in about the different artisans, you know, that, you know, I think Jeannie and Plate and Brian, what you guys do, I mean, it's an art form.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I agree.
Yeah,
you know, it's a creative process.
It really is a creative process. You know, when you were talking earlier, Brian, about, and it might just be how my brain was taking it in, but you were talking about everything that you work with in your little ecosystem there, and you talked about the rotating. Does your planting area where your fish – does that actually move?
Most of our vegetable area remains in vegetables where it's at, and we rotate crops from year to year. There's the crop residue of one crop can be a benefit to the next crop that goes through there. So we turn back
residues. That's the reasoning, is that it can be a benefit. Okay.
Right. And then the pest cycles, you know, say tomatoes have their certain pest. So you don't want to plant your tomatoes in the same spot every year because the bugs that eat tomatoes will lay their eggs right there saying, there's going to be tomatoes here again next year. Let's just sit and wait. So you move those things around and you put something that it would be disruptive to that pest cycle right there the next year.
Yeah.
And so we're always in rotation that way.
So let me ask you, for people that just have their little backyard, little plot there.
Right.
Does it still serve that purpose from the back right-hand corner where my tomatoes were before to move them even like 3 feet away?
Yeah, it would take a little more than that. It's a bit more difficult in a backyard situation.
Yeah.
We'll move our crops, you know, an acre away oftentimes.
Yeah.
So the larger scale that, you know, that you can move things, the better. But it's still opposite side of the garden's got to be better than where it was.
Where it was.
Right.
I don't think I'm probably the only one who might not always think about what you just said about the pests with their eggs.
Uh-huh.
You know, that those would have been laid and
unless you know, you learn about it from people or you're exposed to it. And another thing is that different crops use different nutrients, right?
Sure. So you let those nutrients recover.
Yeah.
Most of what we do, you know, we're a more of a soil farmer than a vegetable farmer. By preparing the soil and having the ecology, the life source in the soil feeds the plants. You know, there's two ways of growing things. We can put a lot of chemicals that are available to the plant to take it up right now, or we can work the soil, which is my preference, is having that soil life there. So the microorganisms, everything that the plants need is in the soil. It might just not be available to the plant right now. And that becomes available as insects and micro life in the soil break those elements down to a point where the plant can now absorb them. So that rotation plays a part in that too, because it takes time for calcium to get released back for a calcium-loving plant species.
Yeah. Now, Jeannie, do you do, besides like vegetables, besides crops, I don't know if I'm using the right terminology, but do you do any, like do you have goats? Do you have any of those?
Okay. I actually am gardening at Urshare Gardens. I'm fortunate enough to have a large plot there where I grow. And
can you share with people who might not know about what Urshare Gardens is?
Urshare is a nonprofit organization that just connects people with Whole Foods, and you know,
and
they have a CSA, and they have community garden plots. They have a donation garden there.
Yeah.
So there's about 10 different types of gardens going on in one place. And it was one of the first CSAs in Lafayette.
It was the first CSA. And people can sign up for community – CSA is Community Supported Agriculture. People can sign up for shares. There's a really long wait list at EarthShare because they're limited with space. And they also do so many collaborative efforts within the community. They have they work with a local judge to do kind of a
first-time offenders program.
Right, first-time offenders.
And school programs.
Yeah, and the Junior League and – they do kind of an edible schoolyard approach as well,
wonderful.
Where people can come out and learn about it. But anybody can go by there. The grower, Robert Fall, he was the catalyst for Acadiana Food Circle. He said, you know, we need a directory, because I went to him and I told him I couldn't grow anything.
Yeah.
So I said, I'll do outreach. I'll do anything. He says, we just need a directory. And that really sparked Acadiana Food Circle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because everybody can, I mean, whatever your talent is, you know.
Yeah, anyone can contribute.
That's right.
Sure. It's located on Louisiana Avenue near Carmel Drive. Been there for about 3 years now at that location. And
on the right,
there's about 4 acres
there.
And just stop by. Robert's always talking to people.
Yeah.
Grab somebody to talk to.
Can we talk a bit about taste? Because I think that's the one thing, you know, if you haven't tasted something right out of the garden in a long time, I think people need to do that.
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's amazing. It's a world of difference.
It really is.
Yeah. And that's – I started – my first CSA was with the Gautreaux, and they picked the vegetables and the produce in the box within, 12 hours? I mean, it's fresh, as fresh as it can get, and I had no idea. I mean, I've never gone back. I always sign up for a CSA.
Oh, yeah, because there's – you go from a lot of times taste to no taste.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just the whole process of shipping a grapefruit from Australia or where, you know, wherever, you lose so much. And this is in your own backyard.
And that is because – okay, so let's talk about that just for a minute. When it goes through that whole time frame of being shipped from quite a ways away, the taste is lost because of the
It's picked before it's ripe, for one thing.
Most,
And it's bred to be tough and hard so it can travel. You know?
It's variety.
Right.
They use varieties selected for shipping that they could actually harvest green, or actually that they could grow with a lot of, you know, with just chemicals.
Yeah.
And then the variety.
Gas them sometime.
And it's accelerated. The whole process is accelerated.
It takes away the whole natural.
And then a whole bunch of people handle it. Right. You know, they kind of get beat up. If you look at stuff, exactly. People walk through the grocery store looking for fruit that doesn't look beat up and vegetables right. That doesn't look that way. And if you go to the farmer's market, it's all pretty
it's
well
all
taken care of.
That's
you know,
right.
There's a
the
lot of
before,
love that
usually.
Goes into it.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you have an event coming up.
We do.
It's the second annual Fresh and Local.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit about that? Let people know what they're going to find out if they come there.
Yes. It's at the Blue Moon again this year on Saturday, March 16th. And we start with a porch jam and a farmer's market in the front yard. And also at that time, we'll have four local food eateries that are featured in the directory that will be serving free food. And then at 9 o'clock, the band starts. So we have Holy Ghost People, Makers Real.
Who's Holy Ghost People?
It used to be Brand New Bag. Patrick Flanagan is
okay.
The lead singer. Yeah.
Patrick that writes for the
independent. Yeah.
Oh, got
yeah.
It. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then we have another independent guy, Sassafras Jubilee, Walter Pierce's band.
Yeah.
The Pits. And then your
you
own.
You gotta love those gals.
Oh, my
Pits.
Gosh. Yeah. They're so much fun. They were actually there last year. And,
yeah.
And everybody loves them. And then your own DJ, Andre Broussard.
That's
he's
right,
going
right
to be.
From KRBS.
Yeah. We'll have a dance party again. That was pretty successful last year.
So that's going to be a week from this Saturday.
Yeah.
And that's at the Blue Moon. But it's and it will benefit Acadiana Food Circle. Mm-hmm. But, too, I think a great time to go out if you do have questions, you want to pick people's brains, mm-hmm. You want to start feeling better.
Yeah. And the great thing is with whether it's the farmers market here, the Hub City Farmers Market, the Freetown, we have one on East Broussard Road. And then there's the Acadiana
and all the
one.
Towns, all the little towns.
Yeah. And
around
all the ones around. And those are all in the directory. You can go and ask Brian, Jeannie, anybody a question and they'll help you learn how to grow. I mean, they're so helpful.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you need to know anything, they're the people to ask.
Wonderful.
Connect you to someone who does.
Right.
That's
yeah.
right. Well, here's to feeling better, mm-hmm. eating better, growing better. Fresh and Local, second annual fundraiser, Saturday, March 16th at the Blue Moon. Please check out acadianafoodcircle.org because that directory is incredible. Great information on there. Jeannie Plaisance, The Growers, and Brian Gautreaux, I want to thank you for coming on.
You're
Tyler
welcome.
Thigpen,
thank
it's thank great so that much. They have you, giving some more direction.
Absolutely.
We're
going to
go out listening.
I think it goes the other way around, but it's
it
fun.
It all works together.
Yeah.
Symbiotic.
That's
yeah.
right. We're going to go out listening to a cut from one of the bands that's going to be playing Maker's Reel. Mm-hmm. And now this is an unreleased cut, correct?
Oh, this is off the demo. And
oh, it's
they're
okay.
actually playing at Festival International this year.
Wonderful.
So we're really excited. Yeah.
Wonderful. Everybody have a good week. This is Maker's Reel. Shadows and panorama.